Stay tuned for your 3CR podcast, featuring interviews from Bundles Fire Radio Show. 3CR is an independent community radio station in Fitzroy, Victoria, on the unceded lands of the Kulin Nation. For more information, go to www.3cr.org.au. Now, Aboriginal health is not a health issue, really. It's more of a political one. And it's the will of these politicians which determines the health of Aboriginal people in this country. I just wonder if Chelsea's sort of looking at that sort of what's going on there, and she's created a thing called the Yanala Manifesto. Yanala's a suburb of Brisbane. She attended a Indigenous Health and Wellbeings conference in Darwin. She issued this manifesto, the Yanala Manifesto. Was inspired by the work of Lester Irrabinna Rigney as a strategy for winning the war of Aboriginal, the gap, I suppose, and the history around poor health for Aboriginal people. The manifesto calls on for a new Indigenous health research paradigm that recognises persistent health inequalities are the product of an ongoing process of colonisation that continues to insist that ill health experienced by Indigenous peoples is a product of black lack, biological or culturally. Foregrounds Indigenous intellectual sovereignty not as a radical or alternative position, but renders visible the strength, capability and humanity of Indigenous peoples in all the processes and products. Recognises health and well-being as a fundamental human right, which means that health research is a question of politics and political struggle rather than simply a production of evidence base for action. Attends to the nature of function of race, not just in how Indigenous people experience racism in health system, but more broadly how race operates to produce the conditions of racialised health inequalities to persist. Demands of health researchers' courage rather than compliance to turn their gaze on how institutions, structures, systems and processes operate to undermine Indigenous health and well-being. Considers disciplinary disloyalty as a form of academic excellence and gathers the thinkers wherever they are located. So that's the gist of Chelsea's Yanala Manifesto. So I hope I'm going to be talking to her very shortly. And actually, she's I'll be back in a minute because she's on the line through. I'll just get her on. 39 minutes past 12 o'clock. You're at the Fire Bundle Inn. I've got a very special guest on the line, none other than Chelsea Bond, who's a, I suppose you can say she's an Indigenous health researcher. She works at the Queensland University of Technology in the Currumbah Institute, I think it was called, where she's been working on issues around health research. That's an important issue, trying to get to understand what's going on here with our people. Good morning. Good afternoon, in fact.
Good afternoon, Chelsea.
Thanks for coming on, sis.
No, thank you so much for having me. I feel very honoured to have the chance.
No, I'm really honoured too, because you've got a very powerful voice, and you know how to use it, and you're starting to produce some really good stuff, like the manifesto, what needs to happen, and
thank you.
So how does research play a part in the scheme of things, and why is it so important, Charles?
Research has been particularly violent for blackfellas. We think about racial violence in terms of the cops on the street, but what enables that racial violence is the intellectual work that makes it rational, natural, inevitable.
Is that the institutionalisation of the process? That's where the actual racism stemming from is, from these institutions. And
well, it's the invention of race itself as an idea, and I'd argue that the academy, even though people get that racism is bad, there still hasn't been a relinquishment of the production of racialised knowledge. And I've got to, I started out as a health worker. you know, at the bottom rung of the racial hierarchy in the health system, and you know, was frustrated with that. And as even in my health worker training, the texts that I had to read about us were just in line with what I knew about ourselves as black fellows. Like, I first started when I was 17 years of age, and I didn't know we were so sick as a people, because at our kitchen table, the stories that were told was about Nani Dora surviving, living to over 90 years of age. So I always thought we were strong, you know?
Well, we're incredibly strong.
Hey, we are. And but when I came to study health and how the white epidemiologists had constructed a knowing about us through health, was that we were destined to die. So these racial ideas are ever present in what we assume are these innocent spaces of, like, health research.
What's that old saying about smooth the dying pillow? Is it that sort of that was their thinking? From the beginning.
And that idea is still there. Like, I just think about, you know, every year we have the Closing the Gap report and the failed targets, and there seems to be this indifference to the persisting health inequalities. And, in fact, some, you know, there are those that see it as inevitable still.
Why is it so? We're such a, the amounts of income that have gone into these identified issues over a long period of time, at least nearly 40 years, more, you know, 50-odd years, when an average people... Yeah, you know, I remember beginning with Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Service, you know.
Yep.
They started to identify these problems and the need for research and identified those sorts of things. But it's all seemed to, that's also seemed to have got flipped on its head, and it's become worse in a sense. And
well, yeah, it's like it's sustained it, it's ingrained it, and what it's done is it's secured up a sense of settler innocence. That they're doing their best.
Look like they're doing something. Yeah,
absolutely. So the NHMRC, in more recent years, has made a commitment. 5% of their budget goes towards Indigenous health. But when you analyse who gets that money,
yes,
and
exactly,
what and where that goes, it's for the careers of non-Indigenous researchers, not for the cause of Indigenous survival.
That's disgusting. And it is really
disgusting. Still very body parts approach. Yeah, it's still very, you know, surveil the black body as though there's something wrong with us.
It's not just the health system that's doing it. It's the legal system as well, and childcare, all those things. This is what happens to the Aboriginal budget. We don't see it. It doesn't reach the ground.
Right.
I think that's the reasons why there's a huge gap. You know, there's a demand that, you know, we need a hell of a lot more resources than what we get. But even the meagre ones that we do basically get, it doesn't reach the ground at all. And there's a huge bureaucracy like taking advantage of that. You know, and none of it's that's been a total failure if you have a look at the history of it.
Yeah, and blackfellas haven't been, you know, passive in this. You know, if we think about best model of primary health care is in the Aboriginal community controlled health sector.
Absolutely.
Which emerged out of denial of health care for,
yes,
blackfellas.
Yes.
But instilled an under-resourcing of that sector that we know is achieving amazing outcomes. And most blackfellas who use a community controlled health service know what the waiting times are. Our systems are under-resourced, despite being the best model of care.
And you know how impatient blackfellas are? I'm one of them. You know, I can't stand there. I can't sit, like, in a hospital, or, you know, I'd rather just take my chances on the street. And I've done that a number of times, just walked away, despite the serious issues I'm facing. Something seriously wrong. And I remember working for the health service back in the day, and, you know, when it was independent and self-determining and community-controlled, they talked about health per se wasn't really a health issue for Aboriginal people. It was more of a political issue and a political issue of political will. And if you look at things like trachoma, which was, you know, the cure for it, was invented here in Australia in the 50s, and yet we got the highest rate of it in the world. You know, it only requires a 10-cent shot in the arm. You know, this is it's criminal what's going on and the way they're you know, I equate it to an act of genocide while they're managing control in our affairs the way they are, very badly.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the issue of Indigenous ill health is not a clinical problem. and that's what we argue with the Nala Manifesto. It is a political problem. And the one text that sustained me in amongst the violence of the white epidemiologist when I was 17 studying was the foreword in the first ever National Aboriginal Health Strategy written in 1989 by the late John Newfong.
Okay.
He spelt that out very clearly. And it's that text I still return to this day.
Okay, yes.
Honouring the tradition of our black critical theorists who had understanding of our situation better than any clinician or epidemiologist ever did.
So what's happened? What's happened over that period of time? Because, you know, like you say, that I think the World Health Organization's adopted our definition of what health was back in the day.
Yep.
They were so impressed by Aboriginal people, you know, in spite of, you know, we're coming out of ghettos and creating policies like that. I was so impressed by the Aboriginal Health Service's early days. You know, they created an independent national body out of nothing, in spite of the government's duty of care and fiduciary obligation. And, you know, that sort of policy was accepted globally as a definition of health. What's going on this planet, if that's the case, you know?
Well, I think one of the challenges, and this is, I guess, why we're looking at how do we build our black intellectual collectives, is that I think that Indigenous health is still a very conservative space. We've forgotten the political foundations on which we exist. And that some people enter into the health system being disciplined by their disciplines, believing in the lies that it tells, and co-sign refreshing of targets rather than a radical reframing of that relationship. And so it's not enough just to have more, you know, black faces in white spaces. We need to return to the black collective strategizing and stand firm on the front line. And that means, and that's why we're calling for a different kind of academic that is courageous.
I can hear what you're saying. You think that many of the wider community can understand what we're talking about here? It's, you know, they think they're doing us a favour. But, you know, you look at the amounts of money, like I said, it doesn't reach the ground. And it's been absorbed somewhere else, infrastructure and car fleets and TA. But doesn't... The programs on the ground don't happen. And what I noticed back in the day, that's when that the programs on the ground were the most important things.
Yep.
And people even were voluntary for these things.
Absolutely. And, I mean, there's limits, I think, to what, you know, with 3% of the population, I mean, we do punch above our weight. But there's also another side of this story and the explicit racial violence in the health system. And we see it in emergency rooms of black fellows being turned away or not being assessed properly. And there are any number of coronial inquiries that are taking place and often get overlooked. So we look at the coronial inquiries into deaths in custody, but there are a whole lot of coronial inquiries happening around deaths in the context of healthcare. And no one is being held accountable.
And that'd be the majority of our premature deaths in this country are in that situation.
And our families have to fight even to get investigations into the preventable deaths. And I've got a PhD student, Helen McKay-Gillick, who has been examining preventable deaths of black fellows in the health system from 2000 to 2018. This is under the closing the gap era. And there's over 4,000 cases that have been referred to the coroner, with only, I think, over just 300 going to coronial inquest.
Okay.
And even then, when they get there, still refuse to look at systemic racism.
Is systemic racism, it's criminal, isn't it? And is criminal neglect a crime? And, you know, how do we get that addressed? Because these are the issues, you know. We're quite capable of taking care of ourselves. We've done it for about a million years before colonisers turned up here.
Yep.
So, you know, the problem is their application of healthcare to our people. It's all tied up in that, and it's. I see it as a form of genocide in the context of Aboriginal people, and if it's this racist criminal actions going on in that level of policy making and thing like that, how did we stop that?
Yeah, well, I mean, back in the day when I was at Aboriginal Health Worker, we used to have to do cultural awareness training, you know, teach them how to treat us as human. I've now shifted in terms of as an academic and doing intellectual work to help inform legal cases to hold the system accountable.
Okay. How's that
and
going?
So we've got a number of expert reports sitting at coronial inquests at present, in which the states are fighting to have kept out. And so rather than appeal to our oppressor, it's about taking up the fight. And what we need to do is build more black fellows willing to join that fight intellectually, politically, legally.
You got me on board. Just
Hey. Well, and the thing is, we got mob that are doing the work, but we need more mob doing the work at their work, not leaving that outside and only going to an Invasion Day protest.
Well, nine to five blackfella.
That's right. And you know, I work in a system that I, you know, critique heavily, and I found a way to exist in it while, you know, calling out its limitations and its
harm. You're the boss on that. And we need to do that. We need to use what we can use in that system. It's, you know, so, you know, don't let that phase you in any way, shape or form.
And I think what's held me, and that's why we're like, when we set up that Inala Manifesto, is what held me is the community of like-minded people.
Yeah, cool.
You know, and we have to remember the power of our community, and when we stand together and we strategize together. And so I guess what we're trying to do is build that community more broadly.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. To listen to a full audio of Bunjil's Fire radio show, a historically informed critical analysis of Aboriginal affairs, and the ongoing political movement for land rights, treaty, sovereignty and the cessation of genocide, go to 3cr.org.au/Bunjil's Fire. If you want to support independent black media on 3CR, please go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.